dividing cells that aren't cancerous, the human expert can quickly check through and eliminate anything that's normal. This kind of algorithmic pre-screening partnership not only saves a lot of time, it also bumps up the overall accuracy of diagnosis to a stunning 99.5%. Marvelous as all this sounds, the fact is that human pathologists have always been good at diagnosing aggressive cancerous tumours. The difficult cases are those ambiguous ones in the middle, where the distinction between cancer and not cancer is more subtle. Can the algorithms help here too? The answer is probably yes, but not by trying to diagnose the tricky categories that pathologists have always used. Instead, perhaps the algorithm, which is so much better at finding anomalies hidden in tiny fragments of data, could offer a better way to diagnose altogether by doing something that human doctors can't. The Nunn Study. In 1986, an epidemiologist from the University of Kentucky named David Snowden managed to persuade 678 nuns to give him their brains. The nuns, who were all members of the School Sisters of Notre Dame, agreed to participate in Snowden's extraordinary scientific investigation into the causes of Alzheimer's disease. Each of these women, who at the beginning of the study were aged between 75 and 103 years old, would take a series of memory tests every year for the rest of their lives. Then, when they died, their brains would be donated to the project. Regardless of whether they had symptoms of dementia or not, they promised to allow Snowden's team to remove their most precious organ and analyze it for signs of the disease. The nuns' generosity led to the creation of a remarkable dataset. Since none of them had had children, smoked, or drank very much, the scientists were able to rule out many of the external factors believed to raise the likelihood of contracting Alzheimer's. And since they all lived a similar lifestyle with similar access to healthcare and social support, the nuns effectively provided their own experimental control. All was going well when, a few years into the study, the team discovered this experimental group offered another treasure trove of data they could tap into. As young women, many of the now elderly nuns had been required to submit a handwritten autobiographical essay to the sisterhood before they were allowed to take their vows. These essays were written when the women were, on average, only 22 years old, decades before any would display any symptoms of dementia. And yet, astonishingly, the scientists discovered clues in their writing that predicted what would happen to them far in the future. The researchers analysed the language in each of the essays for its complexity and found a connection between how articulate the nuns were as young women and their chances of developing dementia in old age. For example, here is a one-sentence extract from a nun who maintained excellent cognitive ability throughout her life. "After I finished the eighth grade in 1921, I desired to become an aspirant at Mankato, but I myself did not have the courage to ask the permission of my parents, so Sister Agreda did it in my stead, and they readily gave their consent." Compare this to a sentence written by a nun whose memory scores steadily declined in her later years. "After I left school, I worked in the post office." The association was so strong that the researchers could predict which nuns might have dementia just by reading their letters. 90% of the nuns who went on to develop Alzheimer's had low linguistic ability as young women, while only 13% of the nuns who maintained cognitive ability into old age got a low idea density score in their essays. One of the things this study highlights is the incredible amount we still have to learn about our own bodies. Even knowing that this connection might exist doesn't tell us why. Is it that good education staves off dementia, or that people with the propensity to develop Alzheimer's feel more comfortable with simple language? But it might suggest that Alzheimer's can take several decades to develop. More importantly, for our purposes, it demonstrates that subtle signals about our future health can hide in the tiniest, most unexpected fragments of data, years before we ever show symptoms of an illness. It hints at just how powerful future medical algorithms that can dig into data might be. Perhaps one day they'll even be able to spot the signs of cancer years before doctors can. Powers of prediction. In the late 1970s, a group of pathologists in Ribe County, Denmark, started performing double mastectomies on a group of corpses. The deceased women ranged in age from 22 to 89 years old, and six of them, out of 83, had died of invasive breast cancer. Sure enough, when researchers prepared the removed breasts for examination by a pathologist, cutting each into four pieces and then slicing the tissue thinly onto slides, these six samples revealed the hallmarks of the disease. But to the researchers' astonishment, of the remaining 77 women who had died from completely unrelated causes, including heart disease and car accidents, almost a quarter had the warning signs of breast cancer that pathologists look out for in living patients. Without ever showing any signs of illness, 14 of the women had in situ cancer cells that had never developed beyond the milk ducts or glands, cells that would be considered malignant breast cancer if the woman were alive. Three had atypical cells that would also be flagged as a matter of concern in a biopsy, and one woman actually had invasive breast cancer without having any idea of it when she died. These numbers were surprising, but the study wasn't a fluke. Other researchers have found similar results. In fact, some estimate that at any one time, around 9% of women could be unwittingly walking around with tumours in their breasts, about 10 times the proportion who actually get diagnosed with breast cancer. So what's going on? Do we have a silent epidemic on our hands? According to Dr. Jonathan Konevsky, a medical innovator and resident in surgery at McGill University in Montreal, the answer is no. At least, not really, because the presence of cancer isn't necessarily a problem. If somebody has a cancer cell in their body, the chances are their immune system will identify it as a mutated cell and just attack it and kill it. That cancer will never grow into something scary. But sometimes the immune system messes up, meaning the body supports the growth of the cancer, allowing it to develop. At that point, cancer can kill. Not all tumours are created equally. Some will be dealt with by your body, some will sit there quite happily until you die, some could develop into full-blown aggressive cancer. The trouble is, we often have very little way of knowing which will turn out to be which. And that's why these tricky categories between benign and horribly malignant can be such a problem. They are the only classifications that doctors have to work with, but if a doctor finds a group of cells in your biopsy that seem a bit suspicious, the label they choose can only help describe what lies in your tissue now. That isn't necessarily much help when it comes to giving you clues to your future. And it's the future, of course, that worried patients are most concerned about. The result is that people are often overly cautious in the treatment they choose. Take in situ cancers, for instance. This category sits towards the more worrying end of the spectrum, where a cancerous growth is present but hasn't yet spread to the surrounding tissue. Serious as this sounds, only around 1 in 10 in situ cancers will turn into something that could kill you. Nonetheless, a quarter of women who receive this diagnosis in the United States will undergo a full mastectomy, a major operation that's physically and often emotionally life-changing. The fact is, the more aggressively you screen for breast cancer, the more you affect women who otherwise would have happily got on with their lives, oblivious to the harmless tumours. One independent UK panel concluded that for every 10,000 women who will be invited to a mammogram screening in the next 20 years, 43 deaths from breast cancer will be prevented. And a study published in the New England Journal of Medicine concluded that for every 100,000 who attend routine mammogram screenings, tumours that could become life-threatening will be detected in 30 women. But depending on which set of statistics you use, 3 or 4 times as many women will be over-diagnosed, receiving treatment for tumours that were never going to put their lives in danger. The problem of overdiagnosis and overtreatment is hard to solve when you're good at detecting abnormalities, but not good at predicting how they'll develop. Still, there might be hope. Perhaps just as with the essay-writing nuns, tiny clues to the way someone's health will turn out in years in the future can be found hiding in their past and present data. If so, winkling out this information could be a perfect job for a neural network. In an arena where doctors have struggled for decades to discover why one abnormality is more dangerous than another, an algorithm that isn't taught what to look for could come into its own. Just as long as you can put together a big enough set of biopsy slides, including some samples of tumours that eventually metastasize, that's spread to other parts of the body, as well as some that didn't, to train your neural network, it could hunt for hidden clues to your future health, blissfully free of the prejudice that can come with theory. As Jonathan Konevsky puts it, it would be up to the algorithm to determine the unique features within each image that corresponds to whether the tumor becomes metastatic or not. With an algorithm like that, the category your biopsy fitted into would become far less important. You wouldn't need to bother with why or how. You could just jump straight to the information that matters. Do you need treatment or not? The good news is work on such an algorithm has already begun. Andy Beck, the Harvard pathologist and CEO of Path AI we met earlier, recently let his algorithm loose on a series of samples from patients in the Netherlands and found that the best predictors of patient survival were to be found not in the cancer itself, but in other abnormalities in the adjacent tissue. This is an important development, a concrete example of the algorithms themselves driving the research forwards, proving they can find patterns that improve our powers of prediction. And of course, there's now an incredible wealth of data we can draw on. Thanks to routine mammogram screening around the world, we probably have more images of breast tissue than of any other organ in the body. I'm not a pathologist, but every expert I've spoken to has convinced me that being able to confidently predict whether a troublesome sample will become cancerous is well within our sights. There's a very real chance that by the time this book is published in paperback, someone somewhere will have actually made this world-changing idea a reality. Digital diagnosis. These ideas apply well beyond breast cancer. The neural networks that Andy Beck and others are building don't particularly care about what they're looking at. You can ask them to categorize anything: dogs, hats, cheeses. As long as you're letting them know when they're getting it right and wrong, they'll learn. And now that this family of algorithms are good enough to be usable, they're having an impact on all sorts of areas of modern medicine. One big recent success, for instance, comes from the Google Brain team, who have built an algorithm that screens for the world's biggest cause of preventable blindness, diabetic retinopathy. It's a disease that affects the blood vessels in the light-sensitive areas of the eye. If you know you have it, you can be given injections to save your sight. But if it's not caught early, it can lead to irreversible blindness. In India, where access to experts capable of diagnosing the condition is limited, 45% of people with diabetic retinopathy will lose some of their sight before they know they have the disease. The Google team's algorithm, which was built in collaboration with doctors from India, is now just as good at diagnosing the condition as a human ophthalmologist. Similarly, there are algorithms that look for cardiovascular diseases in the heart, emphysema in the lungs, strokes in the brain, and melanomas on the skin. There are even systems that diagnose polyps during a live colonoscopy in real time. The fact is, if you can take a picture of it and stick a label on it, you can create an algorithm to find it, and you're likely to end up with a more accurate and possibly earlier diagnosis than any human doctor could manage. But what about the messier forms of medical data? Can the success of these algorithms be taken further to something beyond these kinds of highly specialized, narrowly focused tasks? Could a machine search for meaning in your doctor's scribbled notes, for instance, or pick up on tiny clues in how you describe the pain you're experiencing? How about the ultimate healthcare science fiction fantasy, where a machine in your doctor's surgery would carefully listen to your symptoms and analyze your medical history? Can we dare to imagine a machine that has a mastery of every scrap of cutting-edge medical research, one that offers an accurate diagnosis and perfectly tailored treatment plan? In short, how about something a little like IBM's Watson? Elementary, my dear. In 2004, Charles Lickle was tucking into a steak dinner with some colleagues in a New York restaurant. Partway through the meal, the dining area began to empty. Intrigued, Charles followed the crowd of diners and found them huddled around a television, eagerly watching the popular game show Jeopardy. The famous Jeopardy champion, Ken Jennings, had a chance to hold on to his record-breaking six-month winning streak, and the diners didn't want to miss it. Charles Lickle was the vice president of software at IBM. For the past few years, ever since Deep Blue had beaten Garry Kasparov at chess, the IBM bosses had been nagging Charles to find a new challenge worthy of the company's attention. As he stood in the New York restaurant, watching the diners captivated by this human Jeopardy champion, Lickle began to wonder if a machine could be designed to beat him. It wouldn't be easy. The machine known as Watson that Charles imagined in that restaurant took 7 long years to build. But eventually, Watson would challenge Ken Jennings on a special episode of Jeopardy and convincingly beat him at the game he'd made his own. In the process, IBM would set themselves on the path to their attempt to build the world's first all-singing, all-dancing diagnosis machine. We'll come back to that in a moment, but first let me walk you through some of the key ideas behind the Jeopardy winning machine that form the basis of the medical diagnosis algorithms. For those who've never heard of it, Jeopardy is a well-known American game show in the form of a kind of reverse general knowledge quiz. The contestants are given clues in the form of answers and have to phrase their responses in the form of questions. For instance, in the category self-contradictory words, a clue might be a fastener to secure something, or it could be to bend, warp, and give way suddenly with heat or pressure. The algorithmic player would have to learn to work through a few layers to get to the correct response. What does buckle mean? First, Watson would need to understand language well enough to derive meaning from the question and realize that fastener, secure, bend, warp, and give way suddenly are all separate elements of the clue. This in itself is an enormous challenge for an algorithm. But that was only the first step. Next, Watson would need to hunt for potential candidates that fitted each of the clues. Fastener might conjure up all manner of potential answers. Clasp, button, pin, and tie, as well as buckle, for instance. Watson needs to consider each possibility in turn and measure how it fits with the other clues. So while you're unlikely to find evidence of pin being associated with the clues bend and warp, the word buckle certainly is, which increases Watson's confidence in it as a possible answer. Eventually, once all of the evidence has been combined, Watson has to put its imaginary money where its metaphorical mouth is by choosing a single response. Now, the challenge of playing Jeopardy is rather more trivial than that of diagnosing disease, but it does require some of the same logical mechanisms. Imagine you go to a doctor complaining of unintentional weight loss and stomach aches, plus a bit of heartburn for good measure. In analogy with playing Jeopardy, the challenge is to find potential diagnoses, responses, that might explain the symptoms, clues, look for further evidence on each, and update the confidence in a particular answer as more information becomes available. Doctors call this differential diagnosis. Mathematicians call it Bayesian inference. More on Bayes in the cars chapter. Even after Watson the quiz champion had been successfully created, building Watson the medical genius was no simple task. Nonetheless, when IBM went public with their plans to move into healthcare, they didn't hold back from making grand promises. They told the world that Watson's ultimate mission was to eradicate cancer and hired the famous actor John Hamm to boast that it was one of the most powerful tools our species has created. It's certainly a vision of a medical utopia to inspire us all. Except, as you probably know already, Watson hasn't quite lived up to the hype. First, a prestigious contract with the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center was terminated in 2016. Rumor had it that even after they'd shelled out $62 million on the technology and spent 4 years working with it, Watson still wasn't able to do anything beyond heavily supervised pilot tests. Then in late September 2017, an investigation by the health news website Stat reported that Watson was still struggling with the basic step of learning about different forms of cancer. Ouch. To be fair, it wasn't all bad news. In Japan, Watson did manage to diagnose a woman with a rare form of leukemia when doctors hadn't. An analysis by Watson led to the discovery of 5 genes linked to motor neurone disease, or ALS. But overall, IBM's programmers haven't quite managed to deliver on the promises of their excitable marketing department. It's hard not to feel sympathy for anyone trying to build this kind of machine. It's theoretically possible to construct one that can diagnose disease and even offer patients sensible treatment plans, and that is an admirable goal to have, but it's also really difficult, much more difficult than playing Jeopardy, and much, much more difficult than recognizing cancerous cells in an image. An all-purpose diagnostic machine might seem only a simple logical step on from those cancer-spotting image-based algorithms we met earlier, but those algorithms have a big advantage. They get to examine the actual cells that might be causing a problem. A diagnostic machine, by contrast, only gets information several steps removed from the underlying issue. Maybe a patient has pins and needles caused by a muscle spasm, caused by a trapped nerve, caused by too much heavy lifting. Or maybe they have blood in their stool caused by hemorrhoids, caused by constipation, caused by a poor diet. An algorithm, or a doctor, has to take a single symptom and trace the route backwards to an accurate diagnosis. That is what Watson had to do. It is a monumentally difficult task. And there are other problems too. Remember that dog-wolf neural network? Training that was easy. All the programmers had to do was find a stack of photos labeled dog or wolf and feed them in. The dataset was simple and not ambiguous. But, as Thomas Fuchs, a computational pathologist, told MIT Technology Review, in a specialized domain in medicine, you might need experts trained for decades to properly label the information you feed to the computer. That might be a surmountable problem for a really focused question, such as sorting breast cancer pathology slides into totally benign and horribly malignant. But an all-seeing diagnostic machine like Watson would need to understand virtually every possible disease. This would require an army of incredibly highly qualified human handlers prepared to feed it information about different patients and their specific characteristics for a very long time. And generally speaking, those people tend to have other stuff on their plate, like actually saving lives. And then we come on to the final problem, the most difficult of all to overcome. The trouble with data. Tamara Mills was just a baby when her parents first noticed something wasn't right with her breathing. By the time she was 9 months old, doctors had diagnosed her with asthma, a condition that affects 5.4 million people in the UK and 25 million in the US. Although Tamara was younger than most sufferers, her symptoms were perfectly manageable in the early years of her life, and she grew up much like any other kid with the condition, spending her childhood playing by the sea in the north of England, although always with an inhaler to hand. When she was 8, Tamara caught a nasty bout of swine flu. It would prove to be a turning point for her health. From that point on, one chest infection followed another and another. Sometimes during her asthma attacks, her lips would turn blue. But no matter how often Tamara and her mother went to her doctor and the local hospital, no matter how often her parents complained that she was getting through her supply of inhalers faster than they could be prescribed, none of the doctors referred her to a specialist. Her family and teachers, on the other hand, realized things were getting serious. After two near-fatal attacks that put Tamara in hospital, she was excused from PE lessons at school. When the stairs at home became too much to manage, she went to live with her grandparents in their bungalow. On the 10th of April 2014, Tamara succumbed to yet another chest infection. That night, her grandfather found her struggling for breath. He called an ambulance and tried his best to help her with two inhalers and an oxygen tank. Her condition continued to deteriorate. Tamara died later that night, aged just 13 years old. Asthma is not usually a fatal condition, and yet 1,200 people across the UK die from it every year, 26 of whom are children. It's estimated that two-thirds of those deaths are preventable, as was Tamara's, but that prevention depends entirely on the warning signs being spotted and acted upon. In the 4 years leading up to her final and fatal attack, Tamara visited her local doctors and hospital no fewer than 47 times. Her treatment plan clearly wasn't working, and yet each time she saw a healthcare professional, they only treated the immediate problem. No one looked at the bigger picture. No one spotted the pattern emerging in her visits. No one noticed that her condition was steadily deteriorating. No one suggested it was time to try something new. There is a reason for this. Believe it or not, and anyone who lives here probably will, the UK's National Health Service doesn't link its healthcare records together as a matter of standard practice. If you find yourself in an NHS hospital, the doctors won't know anything about any visits you've made to your local GP. Many records are still kept on paper, which means the method of sharing them between doctors hasn't changed for decades. It's one of the reasons why the NHS holds the dubious title of the world's biggest purchaser of fax machines. Crazy as this sounds, we're not alone. The United States has a plethora of private doctors and large hospital networks that are not connected to each other. And while other countries such as Germany have begun to build electronic patient records, they are a long way from being the norm around the world. For Tamara Mills, the lack of a single connected medical history meant that it was impossible for any individual doctor to fully understand the severity of her condition. Any solution to this profound shortcoming will come sadly too late for Tamara, but it remains a huge challenge for the future of healthcare. A machine like Watson could help save any number of Tamaras, but it will only be able to find patterns in the data if that data is collected, collated, and connected. There is a stark contrast between the rich and detailed datasets owned by data brokers and the sparse and disconnected datasets found in healthcare. For now, medical data is a mess. Even when our detailed medical histories are stored in a single place, which they often aren't, the data itself can take so many forms that it's virtually impossible to connect the information in a way that's useful to an algorithm. There are scans to consider, reports to include, charts, prescriptions, notes, the list goes on. Then you have the problem of how the written data is recorded. You need to be able to understand all the acronyms and abbreviations, decipher the handwriting, identify the possibilities for human error, and that's before you even get to symptoms. Does this person mean cold as in temperature or cold as in cough? Is this person's stomach killing them literally or just hurting a bit? Point is, medicine is really, really complicated, and every single layer of complexity makes the data a little less penetrable for a machine. IBM aren't the only blue-chip big boys to have struggled with the messy, unstructured problem of healthcare data. In 2016, DeepMind, the artificial intelligence arm of Google, signed a contract with the Royal Free NHS Trust in London. DeepMind was granted access to the medical data from three of the city's hospitals in return for an app that could help doctors identify acute kidney injuries. The initial intention was to use clever learning algorithms to help with healthcare, but the researchers found they had to rein in their ambitions and opt for something much simpler because the data just wasn't good enough for them to reach their original goals. Beyond these purely practical challenges, DeepMind's collaboration with the NHS raised a much more controversial issue. The researchers only ever promised to alert doctors to kidney injuries, But the Royal Free didn't have a kidney dataset to give them. So instead, DeepMind was granted access to everything on record. Medical histories for some 1.6 million patients going back over a full 5 years. In theory, having this incredible wealth of information could help to save innumerable lives. Acute kidney injuries kill 1,000 people a month, and having data that reached so far back could potentially help DeepMind to identify important historical trends. Plus, since kidney injuries are more common among people with other diseases, a broad data set would make it much easier to hunt for clues and connections to people's future health. Instead of excitement, though, news of the project was met with outrage, and not without justification. Giving DeepMind access to everything on record meant exactly that. The company was told who was admitted to hospital and when, who came to visit patients during their stay, the results of pathology reports, of radiology exams, who'd had abortions, who'd had depression, even who'd been diagnosed with HIV. And worst of all, the patients themselves were never asked for their consent, never given an opt-out, never even told they were to be part of the study. It's worth adding that Google was forbidden to use the information in any other part of its business, and in fairness, it does have a much better track record on data security than the NHS, whose hospitals were brought to a standstill by a North Korean ransomware computer virus in 2017 because it was still running Windows XP. But even so, there is something rather troubling about an already incredibly powerful, world-leading technology company having access to that kind of information about you as an individual. Problems with privacy. Let's be honest. Google isn't exactly short of private, even intimate information on each of us, but something feels instinctively different, especially confidential, about our medical records. For anyone with a clean bill of health, it might not be immediately obvious why that should be. After all, if you had to choose between releasing your medical data and your browser history to the world, which would you prefer? I know I'd pick the former in a heartbeat and suspect that many others would too. It's not that I have anything particularly interesting to hide, but one is just a bland snapshot of my biological self, while the other is a window straight into my character. Even if healthcare data might have less potential to be embarrassing, Tamandra Harkness, author of Big Data Does Size Matter and presenter of BBC Radio 4 programme Future Proofing, argues that it is still a special case. First off, a lot of people's healthcare data includes a narrative of their life, she told me. For instance, 1 in 3 women in Britain have had a termination. There might be people in their own lives who don't know that. She also points out that your medical record isn't just relevant to you. If someone has your genetic data, she said, they also know something about your parents, your siblings, your children. And once it's out, there's no getting away from it. You can't change your biology or deny it. If someone samples your DNA, you can't change that. You can have plastic surgery on your face, you can wear gloves to cover your fingerprints, but your DNA is always there. It's always linked to you. But why does this matter? Tamandra told me about a focus group she'd chaired in 2013, where ordinary people were asked what concerned them most about their medical data. On the whole, people weren't that worried about their data being hacked or stolen. They were concerned about having assumptions made about them as a group and then projected onto them as individuals. Most of all, they were concerned with how their data might be used against them. Suppose someone had linked their supermarket loyalty card to their medical records. They might go for a hip operation and the doctor would say, "Oh, I'm sorry, we see here that you've been buying a lot of pizzas or you've been buying a lot of cigarettes and therefore I'm afraid we're going to have to send you to the back of the waiting list." That's a very sensible fear in the UK, where some cash-strapped NHS hospitals are already prioritising non-smokers for knee and hip operations. And there are many countries around the world where insurance or treatment can be denied to obese patients. There's something of a conundrum here. Humans as a species could stand to benefit enormously from having our medical records opened up to algorithms. Watson doesn't have to remain a fantasy. But to turn it into reality, we'll need to hand over our records to companies rich enough to drag us through the slog of the challenges that lie between us and that magical electronic doctor. And in giving up our privacy, we'll always be dancing with the danger that our records could be compromised, stolen, or used against us. Are you prepared to take that risk? Do you believe in these algorithms and their benefits enough to sacrifice your privacy? Or, if it comes to it, will you even particularly care? Genetic giveaway. Francis Galton was a Victorian statistician, a human geneticist, one of the most remarkable men of his generation, and the half-cousin of Charles Darwin. Many of his ideas had a profound effect on modern science, not least his work that essentially laid the foundations for modern statistics. For that, we owe Galton a sincere debt of gratitude. Unfortunately, he was also active in the burgeoning eugenics movement, for which we certainly do not. Galton wanted to study human characteristics through data, and he knew even then that you need a lot of it to really learn anything of interest. But he also knew that people had an insatiable curiosity about their own bodies. He realized that when whetted in the right way, people's voracious appetites for an expert's assessment of themselves could override their desire for privacy. What's more, they were often willing to pay for the pleasure of feeding it. And so, in 1884, when a huge exhibition was held in London under the patronage of Queen Victoria to celebrate the advances Britain had made in healthcare, Galton saw his opportunity. At his own expense, he set up a stand at the exhibition. He called it an anthropomorphic laboratory, in the hopes of finding a few people among the millions of visitors who'd want to pay money to be measured. He found more than a few. Punters queued up outside and thronged at the door, eager to hand over a threepenny bit each to enter the lab. Once inside, they could pit their skills against a series of specially designed instruments, testing, among other things, their keenness of sight, judgment of eye, strength of pull and squeeze, and swiftness of blow. Galton's lab was so popular, he had to take two people through at a time. He quickly noticed that it was best to keep parents and children apart during the testing to avoid any wasted time on bruised egos. Writing in a journal article after the event, he commented, "The old did not like to be outdone by the young and insisted on repeated trials." However well or badly each person performed, their results were scribbled on a white card that was theirs to keep as a souvenir. But the real winner was Galton. He left the exhibition with a full copy of everything. A valuable set of biometric measurements for 9,337 people and a handsome profit to boot. Fast forward 130 years, and you might just recognize some similarities in the current trend for genetic testing. For the bargain price of £149, you can send off a saliva sample to the genomics and biotechnology company 23andMe in exchange for a report of your genetic traits, including answers to questions such as, what kind of earwax do you have? Do you have the genes for a monobrow or the gene that makes you sneeze when you look at the sun? As well as some more serious ones. Are you prone to breast cancer? Do you have a genetic predisposition for Alzheimer's disease? The company, meanwhile, has cleverly amassed a gigantic database of genetic information, now stretching into the millions of samples. It's just what the internet giants have been doing. Except in handing over our DNA as part of the trade, we are offering up the most personal data we have. The result is a database we all stand to benefit from. It constitutes a staggeringly valuable asset in terms of its potential to advance our understanding of the human genome. Academics, pharmaceutical companies, and non-profits around the world are queuing up to partner with 23andMe to hunt for patterns in their data, both with and without the help of algorithms, in the hope of answering big questions that affect all of us. What are the hereditary causes of different diseases? Are there new drugs that could be invented to treat people with particular conditions? is there a better way to treat Parkinson's? The dataset is also valuable in a much more literal sense. Although the research being done offers an immense benefit to society, 23andMe isn't doing this out of the goodness of its heart. If you give it your consent, and 80% of customers do, it will sell on an anonymized version of your genetic data to those aforementioned research partners for a tidy profit. The money earned isn't a happy bonus for the company, it's actually their business plan. One 23andMe board member told Fast Company, "The long game here is not to make money selling kits, although the kits are essential to get the base level data." Something worth remembering whenever you send off for a commercial genetic report. You're not using the product, you are the product. Word of warning, I'd also be a bit wary of those promises of anonymity. In 2005, a young man conceived through a completely anonymous sperm donor managed to track down and identify his birth father. By sending off a saliva swab to be analyzed and picking up on clues in his own DNA code. Then in 2013, a group of academics in a particularly famous paper demonstrated that millions of people could potentially be identified by their genes using nothing more than a home computer and a few clever internet searches. And there's another reason why you might not want your DNA in any dataset. While there are laws in place to protect people from the worst kinds of genetic discrimination, so we're not quite headed for a future where a Beethoven or a Stephen Hawking will be judged by their genetic predispositions rather than their talent, these rules don't apply to life insurance. No one can make you take a DNA test if you don't want to, but in the US, insurers can ask if you've already taken a test that calculates your risk of developing a particular disease, such as Parkinson's, Alzheimer's, or breast cancer, and deny you life insurance if the answer isn't to their liking. And in the UK, insurers are allowed to take the results of genetic tests for Huntington's disease into account if the cover is over £500,000. You could try lying, of course, and pretend that you've never had the test, but doing so would invalidate your policy. The only way to avoid this kind of discrimination is never to have the test in the first place. Sometimes ignorance really can be bliss. The fact is, there is no data set that would be more valuable in understanding our health than the sequenced genomes of millions of people. But nonetheless, I probably won't be getting a genetic test anytime soon. And yet, thankfully for society, millions of people are voluntarily giving up their data. At the last count, 23andMe has more than 2 million genotyped customers, while MyHeritage, Ancestry.com, even the National Geographic Genographic Project have millions more. So perhaps this is a conundrum that isn't. After all, the market has spoken. In a straight swap for your privacy, the chance to contribute to a great public good might not be worth it, but finding out you're 25% Viking certainly is. The greatest good. Okay, I'm being facetious. No one can reasonably be expected to keep the grand challenges of the future of human healthcare in the forefront of their minds when deciding whether to send off for a genetic test. Indeed, it's perfectly understandable that people don't. We have different sets of priorities for ourselves as individuals and for humankind as a whole. But this does bring us to an important final point. If a diagnostic machine capable of recommending treatments can be built, who should it serve? The individual or the population? Because there will be times when it may have to choose. Imagine, for instance, you go into the doctor with a particularly annoying cough. You'll probably get better on your own, but if a machine were serving you, the patient, it might want to send you for an X-ray and a blood test just to be on the safe side. And it would probably give you antibiotics too, if you asked for them. Even if they only shortened your suffering by a few days, if the sole objective was your health and comfort, the algorithm might decide it was worth the prescription. But if a machine were built to serve the entire population, it would be far more mindful of the issues around antibiotic resistance. As long as you weren't in immediate danger, your temporary discomfort would pale into insignificance and the algorithm would only dole out the drugs when absolutely necessary. An algorithm like this might also be wary of wasting resources or conscious of long waiting lists, and so not send you for further tests unless you had other symptoms of something more serious. Frankly, it would probably tell you to take some aspirin and stop being such a wimp. Likewise, a machine working on behalf of everyone might prioritize saving as many lives as possible as its core objective when deciding who should get an organ transplant, which might well produce a different treatment plan from a machine that only had your interests in mind. A machine working for the NHS or an insurer might try to minimize costs wherever possible, while one designed to serve a pharmaceutical company might aim to promote the use of one particular drug rather than another. The case of medicine is certainly less fraught with tension than the examples from criminal justice. There is no defense and prosecution here. Everyone in the healthcare system is working towards the same goal, getting the patient better. But even here, every party in the process has a subtly different set of objectives. In whatever facet of life an algorithm is introduced, there will always be some kind of balance between privacy and public good, between the individual and the population, between different challenges and priorities. It isn't easy to find a path through the tangle of incentives, even when the clear prize of better healthcare for all is at the end. But it's even harder when the competing incentives are hidden from view, when the benefits of an algorithm are overstated and the risks are obscured, when you have to ask yourself what you're being told to believe and who stands to profit from you believing it. Chapter 5. Cars. The sun was barely up above the horizon first thing in the morning of the 13th of March 2004, but the Slash X saloon bar in the middle of the Mojave Desert was already thronging with people. The bar is on the outskirts of Barstow, a small town between Los Angeles and Las Vegas, near where Uma Thurman was filmed crawling out of a coffin for Kill Bill 2. It's a place popular with cowboys and off-roaders, but on that spring day, it had drawn the attention of another kind of crowd. The makeshift stadium that had been built outside in the dust was packed with crazy engineers, excited spectators, and foolhardy petrol heads who all shared a similar dream: to be the first people on Earth to witness a driverless car win a race. The race had been organized by the US Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, DARPA, nicknamed the Pentagon's Mad Science Division. The agency had been interested in unmanned vehicles for a while, and with good reason. Roadside bombs and targeted attacks on military vehicles were a big cause of deaths on the battlefield. Earlier that year, they had announced their intention to make one-third of US ground military forces vehicles autonomous by 2015. Up until that point, progress had been slow and expensive. DARPA had spent around $500 million over two decades funding research at universities and companies in the hope of achieving their ambition. But then they had an ingenious idea. Why not create a competition? They would openly invite any interested people across the country to design their own driverless cars and race them against each other on a long-distance track with a prize of $1 million for the winner. It would be the first event of its kind in the world, and a quick and cheap way to give DARPA a head start in pursuing their goal. The course was laid out over 142 miles, and DARPA hadn't made it easy. There were steep climbs, boulders, dips, gullies, rough terrain, and the odd cactus to contend with. The driverless cars would have to navigate dirt tracks that were sometimes only a few feet wide. 2 hours before the start, the organizers gave each team a CD of GPS coordinates. These represented 2,000 waypoints that were sprinkled along the route like breadcrumbs. Just enough to give the cars a rough sense of where to go, but not enough to help them navigate the obstacles that lay ahead. The challenge was daunting, but 106 plucky teams applied in that first year. 15 competitors passed the qualifying rounds and were considered safe enough to take on the track. Among them were cars that looked like dune buggies, cars that looked like monster trucks, and cars that looked like tanks. There were rumors that one contender had mortgaged their house to build their car, while another had two surfboards stuck on their vehicle roof to make it stand out. There was even a self-balancing motorbike. On the morning of the race, a ramshackle lineup of cars gathered at Slash X along with a few thousand spectators. Without any drivers inside, the vehicles took turns approaching the start, each one looking more like it belonged in Mad Max or Wacky Races than the last. But looks didn't matter. All they had to do was get around the track without any human intervention in less than 10 hours. Things didn't quite go as planned. One car flipped upside down in the starting area and had to be withdrawn. The motorbike barely cleared the start line before it rolled onto its side and was declared out of the race. One car hit a concrete wall 50 yards in. Another got tangled in a barbed wire fence. Yet another got caught between two tumbleweeds and, thinking they were immovable objects, became trapped reversing back and forth, until someone eventually intervened. Others still went crashing into boulders and careering into ditches. Axles were snapped, tyres ripped, bodywork went flying. The scene around the Slash X saloon bar began to look like a robot graveyard. The top-scoring vehicle, an entry by Carnegie Mellon University, managed an impressive 7 miles before misjudging a hill, at which point the tyres started spinning and, without a human to help, carried on spinning until they caught fire. By 11 a.m, it was all over. A DARPA organizer jumped in a helicopter and flew over to the finish line to inform the waiting journalists that none of the cars would be getting that far. The race had been oily, dusty, noisy and destructive, and had ended without a winner. All those teams of people had worked for a year on a creation that had lasted, at best, a few minutes. But the competition was anything but a disaster. The rivalry had led to an explosion of new ideas, and by the next Grand Challenge in 2005, the technology was barely recognizable. Second time around, all but one of the entrants surpassed the 7 miles achieved in 2004. An astonishing 5 different cars managed to complete the full race distance of 132 miles without any human intervention. Now, little more than a decade later, it's widely accepted that the future of transportation is driverless. In late 2017, Philip Hammond, the British Chancellor of the Exchequer, announced the government's intention to have fully driverless cars without a safety attendant on board on British roads by 2021. Daimler has promised driverless cars by 2020, Ford by 2021, and other manufacturers have made their own similar forecasts. Talk in the press has moved on from questioning whether driverless cars will happen to addressing the challenges we'll face when they do. Should your driverless car hit a pedestrian to save your life? Asked the New York Times in June 2016. And in November 2016, what happens to roadkill or traffic tickets when our vehicles are in control? Meanwhile, in January 2018, the Financial Times warned trucks headed for a driverless future. Unions warn that millions of drivers' jobs will be disrupted. So what changed? How did this technology go from ramshackle incompetence to revolutionary confidence in a few short years? And can we reasonably expect the rapid progress to continue? What's around me? Our dream of a perfect autonomous vehicle dates all the way back to the sci-fi era of jetpacks, rocket ships, tinfoil spacesuits, and ray guns. At the 1939 World Fair in New York, General Motors unveiled its vision for the future. Visitors to the exhibition strapped themselves into an audio-equipped chair mounted on a conveyor that took them on a 16-minute tour of an imagined world. Beneath the glass, they saw a scale model of the GM Dream. Superhighways that spanned the length and breadth of the country, roads connecting farmlands and cities, lanes and intersections, and roaming all over them, automated radio-controlled cars capable of safely traveling at speeds of up to 100 miles an hour. Strange, the voiceover asked them. Fantastic? Unbelievable? Remember, this is the world of 1960. There were numerous attempts over the years to make the dream a reality. General Motors tried with the Firebird 2 in the 1950s. British researchers tried adapting a Citroën DS19 to communicate with the road in the 1960s. Somewhere between Slough and Reading, you'll still find a 9-mile stretch of electric cable left over from their experiments. Carnegie's NavLab in the 1980s, the EU's $1 billion Eureka Prometheus project in the 1990s. With every new project, the dream of the driverless car seemed tantalizingly only just around the corner. On the surface, building a driverless car sounds as if it should be relatively easy. Most humans manage to master the requisite skills to drive. Plus, there are only two possible outputs, speed and direction. It's a question of how much gas to apply and how much to turn the wheel. How hard can it be? But as the first DARPA Grand Challenge demonstrated, building an autonomous vehicle is actually a lot trickier than it looks. Things quickly get complicated when you're trying to get an algorithm to control a great hunk of metal traveling at 60 miles per hour. Take the neural networks that are used to great effect to detect tumors in breast tissue. You'd think they should be perfectly suited to help a driverless car technology see its surroundings. By 2004, neural networks, albeit in a slightly more rudimentary form than today's state-of-the-art versions, were already whirring away within prototype driverless vehicles, trying to extract meaning from the cameras mounted on top of the cars. There's certainly a great deal of valuable information to be had from a camera. A neural network can understand the color, texture, even physical features of the scene ahead, things like lines, curves, edges, and angles. The question is, what do you do with that information once you have it? You could tell the car, only drive on something that looks like tarmac, but that wouldn't be much good in the desert where the roads are dusty paths. You could say, drive on the smoothest thing in the image. But unfortunately, the smoothest thing is almost always the sky or a glass-fronted building. You could think in quite abstract terms about how to describe the shape of a road. Look for an object with two vaguely straight borders. The line should be wide apart at the bottom of the image and taper in towards each other at the top. That seems pretty sensible. Except, unfortunately, that's also how a tree looks in a photograph. Generally, it isn't considered wise to encourage a car to drive up a tree. The issue is that cameras can't give you a sense of scale or distance. It's something that film directors use to their advantage all the time. Think of the opening scene in Star Wars where the Star Destroyer slowly emerges against the inky blackness of space, looming dramatically over the top of the frame. You get the sense of it being a vast, enormous beast, when in reality, it was filmed using a model no more than a few feet long. It's a trick that works well on the big screen, but in a driverless car, when two thin parallel lines could either be a road ahead on the horizon or the trunk of a nearby tree, accurately judging distance becomes a matter of life and death. Even if you use more than one camera, and cleverly combine the images to build a 3D picture of the world around you, there's another potential problem that comes from relying too heavily on neural networks. As Dean Pomelo, an academic from Carnegie Mellon University, discovered back in the 1990s, he was working on a car called Alvin, the autonomous land vehicle in a neural network, which was trained in how to understand its surroundings from the actions of a human driver. Pomelo and others would sit at the wheel and take Alvin on long drives, recording everything they were doing in the process. This formed the training dataset from which their neural networks would learn. Drive anywhere a human would, avoid everywhere else. It worked brilliantly at first. After training, Alvin was able to comfortably navigate a simple road on its own. But then Alvin came across a bridge and it all went wrong. Suddenly, the car swerved dangerously, and Pomelo had to grab hold of the wheel to save it from crashing. After weeks of going through the data from the incident, Pomelo worked out what the issue had been. The roads that Alvin had been trained on all had grass running along the sides, just like those neural networks back in the medicine chapter, which classified huskies on the basis of snow in the pictures. Alvin's neural network had used the grass as a key indicator of where to drive. As soon as the grass was gone, the machine had no idea what to do. Unlike cameras, lasers can measure distance. Vehicles that use a system called LIDAR, light detection and ranging, first used at the second DARPA Grand Challenge in 2005, fire out a photon from a laser. Time how long it